Prime ministers
and presidents
may come and go, but the certainty of exemplary entertainment on the Midweek Drive
and the Midweek Drive Morning Edition
remains.
Well, hands, face, space, you certainly should have actually had that hammered home. But if you haven't, then certainly the next few moments will make that quite clear, because we're delighted to welcome to the programme today to talk about the absolute vital importance of the work that he's doing and the work that the NHS is doing, and how we can literally look people in the eye and say, we're doing our bit as well. We're pleased to welcome Dr. Emeka Okorocha. How are you, Emeka?
Hi, thank you, Alex. I'm as good as you can be in these times, you know what I mean?
This is the point, because clearly from your own day-to-day work, you're very much at the heart end, the sharp end, etc., of this huge pandemic, which I think we've hopefully gone beyond the notion now that, oh, it's just like a mild form of the flu, you know, what the hey, we'll carry on regardless, because that was very much the kind of one of the narratives that was being fed to us over the last few months. It's a lot more serious than that, and certainly this second strain seems to be even more problematic.
100%. I think we were trying to be optimistic, and I think in that sense we're a little bit naive in terms of I feel like we did kind of underestimate this in some areas. We were hoping it would pass, and there were times where it looked like it would, but unfortunately we couldn't really predict how bad the second strain would hit us. They're said to be almost every 30 seconds somebody's admitted with coronavirus, and then you're looking at 35,000 people in beds with COVID, with a quarter of those being under 55. Those are pretty staggering statistics. And then this new strain of the virus is 50 to 70% more transmissible and more contagious, and then potentially 30% more lethal. It's just, the stats don't look good. The numbers aren't lying at the moment. The stats don't look good.
Absolutely. Now, we're also joined today by Rebecca Bond, who is experiencing, obviously, the whole pandemic, as all of us are, by having to do her university work remotely, as indeed we're teaching online, etc. I mean, Rebecca, you've seen this video that has been released. What are your initial thoughts with respect to the video itself, and what questions do you have for Dr. Okorocha?
I think it's brilliant and really important. I think it's easy for someone who isn't witnessing the true extent of the effect of the pandemic, such as myself, it's easy to forget the real extent to which you're experiencing it. Obviously, you're seeing this on the front line every day. How is that, and how is the extent that, you know, people like me, for example, aren't witnessing?
Honestly, Rebecca, it's going to be tough for you to envision what we go through in those shifts.
I can imagine.
Some of the things we see in those shifts, you don't wish that anyone would see, to be honest. And I think that was the kind of the rationale behind the campaign and the advert, was to kind of give a glimpse into the lives of NHS healthcare workers and a glimpse into the lives of the patients who are suffering with coronavirus, talking about how they miss their families, who they're not able to see, how they're in doubt of whether or not they'll ever leave hospital. It's something that very few of us can even envision. Me even talking to the patients every day, I can't even imagine what they're going through on those beds. I see what my colleagues are going through, and it's very tough for everybody. I feel like, yes, like you said, people do care a lot, but it's hard to really understand what we're going through about seeing it. They do say seeing is believing. And so the campaign advert was to push that and reiterate that topic to people, that, you know, we are on the front line and this is what we're seeing. And it's a lot worse than people do see and think in their minds.
Definitely.
We've talked to people before in the medical profession about, obviously, the way the thing is panning out, etc. And clearly an awful lot is being pinned on the vaccine and vaccination and the processes that are going through now. And we've spoken to people who have been vaccinated and worked through that whole issue. But it's important to say that just because the vaccine is out there, three of them, of course, and it's being distributed, and apparently we're doing quite well as far as that's concerned, this is a global pandemic. So on that basis alone, presumably this importance of adhering to certainly safe social distancing and so on is going to be something we need to be very much with and part of our lives over the next few months, Emeka.
Yeah, 100%. Like you said, Alex, the vaccine obviously is a glimmer of hope. Is a potential way out. We have two vaccines now circulating around in the UK, which is great. Me, myself, I've been vaccinated. Many of my colleagues have had their first dose of the vaccine. And we do stress to each other. We do stress to the public that just because you've had the vaccine doesn't mean you should ease up at all on any of the rules and regulations and the guidance. I mean, we know that the vaccine reduces the severity of the disease and reduces the chance of spread. However, it doesn't stop you from contracting the disease, nor does it completely stop you from spreading the disease. And so we still need to go through the processes ourselves. We're still wearing masks every day, completely, fully, while we're at work. When you're out in public, the same thing. Obviously, hands, face, space, to make sure we're washing our hands. I mean, for me, it's just routine now. Every time I do anything, I'm washing my hands. I'm surprised I don't wear a mask here at home because it's just become routine. And obviously, creating space between people is just imperative. It's like, yo, back off, anyone you see. And that's just the thing now. So regardless of whether you've had the vaccine or not, it shouldn't really change your mindset in terms of what you still need to be doing, because we do know from the scientists and what they're telling us that we're still in a position where coronavirus can still be spreading around here. And until most of us have had the vaccine, I know it's reached about 4 million people, but until most of us have had the vaccine, especially the most vulnerable people, we need to kind of be vigilant in what we're doing.
There's one very heartrending moment in all of the whole video is full of heartrending moments. But I think when the nurse actually looks into camera and basically says she's had to just break the news that to a patient that their lungs have basically stopped working because they've been impacted by the disease. Those are the kind of real challenges that we want to hopefully minimize and ideally avoid.
Yes, completely. Alex, I can't tell you how many times I've had to look at a chest x-ray and then just think, oh, and you just get that feeling like, you need to go and tell them now what the likely prognosis is, and you see it. And then a colleague will be walking by the monitor and say, and they'll see the chest x-ray and they'll be like, who's that? That patient in bay four? Oh no, that sort of thing. We've come to the realization where we know how this disease works in hospital now. We're quite experienced with it. I've been working with COVID for almost a year, and I'm surely going on to a completely COVID ward. You know what looks bad. You know that what doesn't spell a good prognosis and prediction of the disease. And you have to kind of explain this to the patients, especially because they sometimes know it. They look at you in their eyes, you see fear, and they know. They know how they feel. They know that they're not getting any better. They know that they're breathless, and they can feel the vibe from the doctor. So you do what you can to try and encourage them. However, in the back of your mind, you know, at some point you might have to make a call to the family and say, this looks like it's getting towards the end. And that's something that none of us want to do. And it's a very, very, very difficult task. And no matter how many times we do it, you can never really get used to telling a family member who can't even see their loved one that mom or dad might not make it out of the hospital, unfortunately. So we need to start planning for keeping them comfortable and doing all we can in that respect.
Absolutely. Rebecca, any final closing questions from yourself?
Yeah, well, I mean, it can't be any more obvious to the public that we need to be doing our part. We need to be adhering to the principles of hands, face and space. There is the ongoing need for caution. If listeners could come away with one thing, what would you think that you'd want listeners to come away from this interview knowing?
The one thing I want listeners to know is that this is a lot more severe than you think. No matter what you're thinking at the moment, it's more severe than that, because I don't think you can really understand the gravity, even myself working there. It's sometimes hard to understand exactly what I'm seeing day by day and exactly how many people are dying. We've had more than 1,000 people die every day the last 10 days. And those numbers are staggering. People need to understand that. I do know it's frustrating being at home. I do know lockdown is nothing that we're made for. We're social people. And up until last year when we started, I don't think any of us had experienced anything like a lockdown before. But it's about, one, taking care of yourselves and your family whilst you're at home. I know it's had a massive impact on people's mental health and physical health at home, but it's up to people for you to take your health in your hands, making sure you're finding techniques to keep your mental health as optimum as possible, making sure you're finding techniques to keep your physical health as optimum as possible. And that way, that can hopefully ease things off and hopefully make it easier for you to follow the government guidelines and stay at home. And then hopefully from that, we'll protect ourselves and we'll protect our NHS.
Dr. Emeka, thank you so much for your frontline work and your colleagues as well. It's appreciated. It's never overlooked.
Yeah, absolutely. And endorsing that, Dr. Emeka Okorocha, huge thanks. Keep on keeping on. You are a genuine NHS superhero, and keep saving lives, Emeka.
Appreciate that, guys.
Thanks so much. Take care.
One of the best things about the 21st century has to be the variety of creative ways radio has evolved. The legacy of Marconi is in good hands with Alex Levchuk and the Midweek Drivettes.
Over a decade ago, the organisation Girls Out Loud was formed to form a more empowering mindset in girls that actually inspires them to think big, reach for the stars and make better life choices. We're delighted to actually welcome the founder of aforementioned Girls Out Loud today to talk about some very sobering news, actually, and some very concerning news, really, that even in the third decade of the 21st century, we still seem to have huge gender inequalities. But to talk us through this and address some of the key things within this, as mentioned, the founder of Girls Out Loud, ace entrepreneur, the wonderful Jane Kenyon. How are you, Jane?
I'm fine, thanks very much. I'm fine. I'm not underwater, that's the main thing. Lots of flooding my way, but I'm good this morning.
Now, Jane, when we spoke, I think a year or so ago, we were obviously sort of keen to obviously promote the organisation to make sure that, that messages are getting out there. Since then, of course, nobody had anticipated the challenges we've faced globally. You mentioned, obviously, the most recent, of course, being floods and various other factors. But this recent survey, which suggests that actually there are huge possibilities of another generation of lost girls sort of not getting the kind of breaks that we all as human beings should have as a matter of right, perhaps. Talk us through some of the sort of findings that you've come across within this this recent study.
Well, I mean, this isn't my study. These are lots of stats coming out around mental health and well-being for teenage girls. And, you know, as you well know, we were in a mental health crisis before COVID. COVID certainly isn't the cause of it, but it has amplified it. So we are now seeing lots more online issues with grooming. We're seeing a lot more mental health issues around depression, panic attacks, self-harming, suicide. We're seeing, as we well know, that home is not necessarily a safe place for a lot of young people. So we've seen neglect increase, domestic violence increase. And, you know, one of the most worrying things for me, recent research shows that we have reversed a decade of progress on social mobility in the past 12 months. And that's heartbreaking because that means that the gap between the rich and the poor is continuing to widen. And, you know, we are leaving some of those poor children behind. I mean, the question I have is, you know, will they ever catch up? I mean, how will they catch up from losing 12 months of education, you know, just being locked in homes that may not necessarily be the best place to be. So Girls Out Loud is actually on a mission to get those girls back in school. Because school is the safe place. School is more than a place just to do English, maths and science. School is a place where they can access support. They can access organisations like Girls Out Loud that can spot safeguarding issues early and prevent a lot of pain. School is a place where they have friends and advocates and a structure and a chance of an education and for some of them a meal. So, you know, we need to open schools for vulnerable and at-risk teenage girls, and we need to do it now because we can't neglect their mental health and well-being any longer. And if we do, we will seriously struggle to catch up. I mean, there are lots of head teachers coming out about this now saying they don't even know that they've got the resources to deal with this when the children do go back. So the quicker we get these girls back into school, the better. Because what is the alternative?
Well, I mean, you raised that, Jane, of course, and I'm sure that we can listen to politicians until they are blue in the face and they'll still actually talk about the same sort of rhetoric. Clearly something needs to be done with respect to this. You said there that actually we've lost almost the excellent work you've done in the last decade in terms of 12 calendar months. Is it a case of people turn a blind eye, that there's a case of, oh, it's not my problem, basically? Is it a case of there's the kind of uncertainty that unless they're actually doing a press conference or something, you know, is it as bad as the fact that actually we haven't realised actually that there is a major challenge here that actually
maybe
affects
us all?
Maybe
we think it's not happening to our children. Maybe we think, oh, these things only happen, you know, self-harming and depression and mental wellness, if you like, only happens to very vulnerable girls, weak girls or girls that are, you know, coming from poor families. And that's not true. That is not true. You know, mental wellness, mental health issues happen to all girls. You know, we work in some very high private sector schools, and it's exactly the same. So it isn't the domain of the poor. You know, it's the world that they're living in. It's the pressures that they're under. It's the social media and the smart technology. It's the reality TV telling them how they're supposed to look and how they're supposed to behave. And it's all sorts of things that are mainstreamed onto their smartphone. So, you know, it happens to all girls. You know, the stats wouldn't be as high if it was just a certain niche. So I do think there's an element of denial about it, or there's an element of, well, it's not happening to my child, when you don't, and most of the time you don't even know. And, you know, it's a big issue, and maybe we don't quite know how to tackle it, or we think, oh, well, it'll just go away, or, well, school does that, don't they? It's school's responsibility to do that. And it's not just school's responsibility, it's all of our responsibility. You know, one of the things I'm really keen to do is to engage big businesses in this and brands, because there are lots of brands out there targeting teenage girls. And I think that they should be responsible for that and be investing in their wellness. So, you know, one of the things that we're doing is we're putting a call out there to the big companies to use their corporate social responsibility wisely and to invest in the next generation. Because if we don't, we won't have one. We'll just miss a decade. We won't have one.
Which, as I say, will impact us all, no matter what sort of situation we happen to be on the planet. Now, in years gone by, people will look nostalgic and say, well, obviously the family would look after this. You'd have a kind of support structure, support network there. As you've already said, there are cases where that's not the case, no matter what your socioeconomic background happens to be. But there was something which I was quite intrigued by, which is obviously the need for big sisters and a kind of mentoring line from that. Could you just share with us how you kind of envisage that working and how that can also hopefully get involved
with us?
We've
been running big mentoring programs for over a decade. And the idea is that we train role models, female role models, from all walks of life, entrepreneurs, corporate women, women running charities, coaches, women working in broadcast media. I mean, you name it, we've got women across all sectors. We train them to be a mentor to a girl that's 12 or 13, and they have a one-to-one relationship with her for 12 months. And they also do group work with her. We do workshops on all a wide range of subjects. And that relationship is really important. It's really rich, and it's rich for both of them. It's the kind of parallel journey, because what we're about is helping girls find their voice. We're about helping girls recognize their potential. We're about helping girls kind of put their hand up and ask and get more involved in opportunities. And so that's how the relationship works. And, you know, the girls blossom. They blossom throughout that process. And it's really important that they have somebody to talk to who's on their side, who doesn't already have an agenda. So if you think about a teenage girl, she's got a mom, she's got aunties, she's got teachers, she might have a social worker, she might have a counsellor, she's got all these people in her life, but they've all got an agenda. They're all very much linked to her. They know her background. Whereas if you talk to a stranger, if you talk to someone that doesn't have that baggage, you quite often will have conversations with them that you would not have with somebody else. And so you get somebody that's on your team that doesn't know your background, that only knows what you tell them, that can help you grow and develop resilience and look at different ways of dealing with things and develop some coping skills. So it's a really important relationship. And I think every girl should have a big sister, because the girls that do get to have that, the shift in their mindset and the shift in how they feel about themselves and the shift in how they feel about the way they look and their body confidence, and they stop taking dangerous risks online, and the way they feel about their own body so that they respect themselves when it comes to boys, it's huge. It makes a huge impact on them.
Yeah, as we said, a whole range of sort of issues with respect to that. You alluded to social media, of course. I mean, the trials of TikTok could be a whole new world that we're going into, but let's not go there. Somebody's listening to this, Jane, they're sort of, I may know somebody, or they might have a connection, or indeed they might be sort of suffering themselves. What would your advice be in terms of taking those first steps to actually getting some not necessarily objective help, but at least the sort of possibility of seeing a route to the light at the end of the
tunnel? If I'm talking about a teenage girl, my advice is always do not hold this in inside. Talk to somebody, ideally an adult that you trust. You know, that could be somebody in your family, somebody outside your family, a teacher, one of your friends' mums. You know, it doesn't matter. Talk to somebody, because it's no good keeping it in. And if you haven't got an adult in your life like that, then ring us. There's lots of helplines. There's lots of people out there that will support you and will talk you through things. But please don't suffer in silence. That's the worst thing that you can do. And, you know, if you want to get in touch with Girls Out Loud, if you run a company, if you want to support us, if you want to step up and be a mentor, then go to our website, girlsoutloud.org.uk, and all the information is on there to get involved in our work.
Jane Kenyon, speaker, author, coach, and, of course, founder of Girls Out Loud. Always make that absolutely clear in terms of it's not the the band from the
Simon Cowell regime.
Exactly, Girls Out Loud. And let's face it, Jane, I think those girls also need your help. So let's face it, you know, even in their latter sort of years, but that's
absolutely,
fine.
Absolutely.
For the moment, many thanks indeed. Keep up the excellent work. And let's hope that, as I say, when we speak again, that the prognosis is slightly better, because, as let's I say, after a decade of progress, it's a tragedy indeed if we're sort of slipping back due to events beyond our control.
Thank you.
The magic of the midweek drive has embraced Zoom as wholeheartedly as it once did the minidisc. Truly, the 21st century has arrived.
It is that time where, as far as the Midweek Drive Morning Edition is actually concerned, we actually focus on film, cinema and various other factors. And joining us today for her first experience of the Robin Pierce, Richard Fitzwilliams film review extraordinaire, we have Rebecca Bond. How are you, Rebecca?
I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
I'm good. And like yourself, I've managed to watch one of Richard's two suggestions. That's primarily because I think we were both a wee bit confused. Was it Dear Comrade? Was it Dear Comrades? Dear Comrades? Dear Comrade? It's the one that's in the Curzon cinema. I think it's all dealing with a kind of revelation. I don't think it's Dear Comrade. We'll find out. Anyway, it's a delight as ever to welcome, obviously, that dynamic duo. Start off with the Robin in the Batman. That's Robin. How are you, Robin?
Hello there. Happy to play second fiddle to Richard.
There you are. Robin Pierce. Exactly. Or indeed, as you might possibly well say, holy priceless collection of portrait paintings, Richard. It's just a thought. Richard Fitzwilliams, good morning. How to you? How are you?
I'm fine, but I am, as I was saying a few minutes ago, very depressed with the news of postponements, and particularly that of No Time to Die until November. It's very depressing.
Okay, let's hold that thought, because I know Robin's got some interesting things to say on that part of you, but let's test it. Rebecca, are you devastated by the fact that Daniel Craig's last Bond movie has yet again been kicked back way into 2022?
Devastated. What, 2021? Yeah, well, I'm actually a Bond myself, if you didn't know. I'm a Bond, so yeah. I was actually going to star in that one, so very disappointed.
You aren't, you see. So Rebecca's lost it on that sort of basis. Robin, your thoughts on this, and also from the point of view of the industry of cinema and multiplexes and so on.
Well, I think it is, as Richard said, it's absolutely devastating, because the big chains still have to pay their rent and their leases. And, you know, Cineworld in particular have had a loan to keep them going this year, but they need a summer blockbuster season. They don't need just one. They need a whole slew of them. Now, of course, things like the Bond film being released isn't helping at all, because the way the industry is going, even though Warners are simultaneously streaming and doing cinema releases in other countries, America, for example, they can't show films to an audience that's not there. The audience won't come there unless there's something that they want to see. I mean, films like last year's Tenet is, by any means, whatever you think of the film, it's more of a niche film. It's not the big mainstream blockbuster that everybody and their aunts and uncles and their cousins and their friends will all go and see together, like, love them or hate them, a Marvel, a Star Wars, a Disney, a Pixar, any of those. But, you know, the Bond film would be that kind of experience. And the other problem, I think, is at the end of the day, it's a Bond film, okay? It's not going to be great cinema. It's a Bond film. We all know what to expect because we've been watching them for 60 years.
Yes, but they haven't been written by Phoebe Waller-Bridge before, so let's face it, it could go all over the place. It could destroy the franchise.
This is the question. The fact that they keep... Oh, no. we're moving it to a more favourable slot, building up our expectations. And will it fall short of those built-up expectations, pretty much like Wonder Woman 84 did, in a way? Wonder Woman 84 was not a perfect film, but our expectations, because we'd had it dangled in front of our faces for so long, built up our expectations. Is Bond going to be the same? But like Richard, I really do, at this moment, weep for the future of the shared experience of seeing a film with big sound on a big screen with total strangers. And if they're anything like the Star Wars audiences that I've seen those films with on opening night, complete strangers will come up to you just to compare notes. You know, it's a big social event that you can share with strangers and make new friends along the way. We're going to miss all that, because once it is gone, it will never come back.
I'm wondering. I mean, I have exactly the same concerns as you have, but just to touch on your last comment, once it's gone, it will never come back. I can't help feeling that Warner's made it clear that simultaneously they're streaming and also releasing films in cinemas, the cinemas that are open, that is, because California and New York are both in dreadful crises when it comes to COVID. You know, who is going to go? And so far as expectations are concerned, I mean, I do think that if there is one film, simply because it is a Bond, I mean, I agree, we've been seeing them 60 years. It's just that this particular one, because it's been postponed so much, because it's Daniel Craig's last, because there is the expectation that it will be very new, simply because a lot of the Bond franchise, let's face it, was very tired, with ups and downs. I mean, Craig's had successes, and also there's been nonsense. Quantum of Solace.
Richard, don't start on Quantum of Solace. Just step away from that battle entirely. Otherwise, I'll bring on the man from Uncle as well.
Alex. I have to be frank with you. It isn't a battle. You're fighting a war that you already lost when they said the excuse for that dreadful screenplay was a screenwriter's strike in Hollywood. You only do
yes,
that.
But you've got music by the White Stripes. What's not to appreciate in that sort of instance? It's hugely wonderful. Anyway, let's quick question for Rebecca. You are the future of cinema going. I mean, the likes of Robin, Richard, and myself probably would say, "Well, we've had our few decades of enjoyment in cinema, etc. It's time to actually shut the whole thing down now." What are your thoughts, Rebecca?
Oh, nonsense!
Absolute nonsense. I've still got years left.
there is such a shared experience.
Dismantle him, please. He's
Richard.
Yeah, there's such a shared experience in going to, as Robin said, a place of strangers on the big screen with stereo sound. It's a completely different experience to sitting in your living room and watching, for example, Netflix. It's not the same experience whatsoever. I think having that completely different scenery, setting, that cinematic experience is definitely something that even people in my generation experience, and I think would greatly be missed if we took that away.
I don't think it will be taken away, because obviously it's always when cinemas reopen, which eventually they will, it will be there. My fear is that with so many people able to stream from home, which you can't in the same way, anything like the same way in theatre and concerts and ballet and opera, and also the fact that costs, you know, I mean, that people have home cinemas, they have large televisions, all of this makes it increasingly difficult to draw people into cinemas, which was happening before the pandemic. But the streaming policy, there's this one question that one has to ask. Mark Kermode was saying this. Once you offer consumer choice, are you going to take it away? That 90 days, which was so pivotal in Hollywood, did vary from film to film sometimes. But I mean, between theatrical release and streaming, is that ever going to be reinstated? It's a very real problem, this.
Richard, I've said the solution is quite simple. You just actually hike up the price of the cinema ticket. So those who want to go to cinema tickets will shell out £60 or £70 for the privilege. End off. Richard.
That makes it more elitist, though, doesn't it? You're throwing away.
Like opera, like ballet, and so on. It's the way to the future.
But you're trying to limit then the choice of good quality entertainment with the best possible presentation to the favoured few that could afford it. And that makes it elitist. I mean, I grew up and, you know, my parents told me that stuff like classical music, oh, it's not for the likes of us. In time, I grew to appreciate classical music, and it's not for the better educated. Even, you know, the lads like me can appreciate a nice tune. Films would be just the same.
You see, that's what happens, Richard. You see, you open the whole thing through and you get the Welsh following the whole thing all sorts of ways. Sorry. Enough of such banter and such like material.
It's also the case, Alex. I mean, one thing I don't think is going to happen is that prices are going to be anything like the level that you put them at, because that really, really would be crippling. I think theatre prices have gone up, and this is a fact. I mean, you know, there's no question if you look at theatre prices over the last decade and the way they've increased over the last 20 years, it would be simply phenomenal examining them. And the facts are, however, that there are concessions, and of course you've got the National Theatre. So time has come also, if you're thinking of large price hikes, which may happen, but you'd also have concessions, and that's pivotal, as Robin was saying, because I mean, you really otherwise will, if you can screen it at home within a relatively short period of time, then people will be asking, despite the fact that you could be disturbed by telephone calls, knocks at the door, children, anything could disturb you.
You keep saying this, Richard. I'm going to just quickly ask Rebecca, when you watched One Night in Miami, were you disturbed by telephone calls, knocks on the door, or anything else in the particular area?
I wasn't actually, but that could have been that it was evening time. But
there we are. All right. Richard, over to you. One Night in Miami. Talk us through it.
One Night in Miami, and it's a particularly interesting film because obviously one of the things that's been discovered, and I say discovered, it's ironic with cinema having lasted for as long as it has, to have had so few films dealing with the African-American experience, and particularly to concentrate on African-American actors, it really is extraordinary. This was based on a debut play by Kemp Powers in 2013, and it's a fictional account of a particular night when Cassius Clay at 22 was newly crowned a boxing champion of the world when he celebrated the surprise win over Sonny Liston. Now, this is directed by Regina King. She won an Academy Award for If Beale Street Could Talk, an underestimated film, I thought, and she played the troubled mother in it, and I thought extremely well. And here we have, firstly, a series of vignettes at the beginning of the film where Cassius Clay gets a surprise when he fights Henry Cooper, when we have soul singer Sam Cooke playing before an audience that's all white and pretty indifferent. You've got the NFL player Jim Brown, who sees a supposed friend, Mr. Carlton, but, well, he won't be allowed in the house because he's black. And then Malcolm X, well, he is somewhat tormented because he plans to leave the Nation of Islam, and discusses it with his wife. And then we see them all in 1964, they're in Miami for Clay's title bout against Sonny Liston. And after the fight, Clay is going to announce he's joined the Nation of Islam, which Malcolm X is just about to leave, unbeknown to Clay. And it's a fascinating play with these four African-American icons. Some of them, then basically they've all got the same agenda, but they approach it in totally different ways. They have a certain amount of power, but one thing having the power, it's another thing the way you use the power. And you have at clash of personalities, especially between Cook and Malcolm X, because Malcolm X believes he's sold out to white audiences, whereas he has completely different plans, but and in a different way. You've also got Cassius Clay, always a wonderful character, and no disappointment here, played by Eli Gore. Clay, of course, is full of himself, as always, after his title victory. You've got Leslie Odom Jr., giving an excellent performance as Cook, who sees power as something far, far more modulated and far, far more carefully handled than the Malcolm X played by Kingsley Benadire, who in fact is himself torn between the schism with Elijah Muhammad in the Nation of Islam and also what he wants for the African-American community. And then you've got Aldis Hodge playing Jim Brown, who has his sights set on Hollywood. And it's the dynamic between these different characters that it's dramatic. It is a film play, that one has to say. But having said that, you've got a first-class cast, and you've got the drama and the way the characters clash with each other, the way, as I say, wanting the same thing. We've got also a timely film at the moment with the BLM movement, with so much discrimination still existing, and also the fact that we are, it's almost a question of discovery of African-American cinema, because we have Spike Lee, of course, and I mean, but it was only for the same, I mean, if you take superheroes, which is Robin's speciality, movies of the sci-fi movies, Black Panther was relatively recent. And I mean, this is a very well-directed drama, and there's a claustrophobia, and it's atmospheric, quite claustrophobic, this one night in Miami, because you've got these different views, clashes of personality, and also interesting. It's a fictional event, but it draws you in. So I would recommend it very strongly.
Well, from my own point of view, I thought Beau Bridges, and I thought you handled the words that Beau Bridges used and admitted it very effectively there, Richard. I thought you'd actually work that in the interaction between Beau Bridges' character and, of course, Jim Brown, the character thereupon. So that was good. I certainly had huge sympathy for Sam Cooke's version of the whole system. I think the BLM thing is potentially quite dangerous because it opens up a political ideology which is interesting, but at the same time has got other agendas at work, so that we have to be careful of that. But I would probably score it a good 7 out of 10 because I actually enjoyed it much more than Ma Rainey's Black Bottom for different reasons. Rebecca, your first experience of this, how did you find this uninterrupted hone screaming of One Night in Miami?
I really enjoyed it. I think to me, a good film is something you can be engrossed in, but you also take something away from it. And I think it talked about issues that were important, such as racial division, for example. It was a lesson of acceptance between different ideologies of politics, culture, identity, the part where there's a discussion about what issues Sam Cooke should be singing about. There's the issue of identity there. I think it really does talk about important issues. And to me, that's what makes a film enjoyable, because there's a takeaway from it. So I enjoyed it.
And I suppose actually it ties in very much with our recent midweek drive, because of course Sam Cooke was being compared with Bob Dylan, and of course who we were speaking to literally hours ago, Melanie, who was being referred to in the press as the female Bob Dylan, as she said Bob Dylan wasn't referred to as the male Melanie. So interesting sort of period of time, and a good capturing, I think, of that particular moment. However, does this tempt Robin to actually say, what the hey, I'm going on Amazon Prime now and I'm going to watch One Night in Miami?
One thing I'm not really clear on is this a fictionalized sort of account of things that may have happened, or I mean, of course, it's not a documentary. Is it history being rewritten to fit the modern day at all, or I mean, how authentic is it?
Well, I mean, it is a fictional event. The four of them didn't meet in the way it's portrayed, but symbolically.
They did meet, Richard. They did meet.
But not in the context of
I see.
This particular film.
I, I might well give this one a go. I'd just like to add at this point that as soon as I came off the air with you last week, I did sit and watch and really enjoy Enola Holmes very much, very, very much, to the point that Alex called it right down the line. I love the soundtrack so much. I bought the CD and it's been playing on a loop most of the week.
It's written by the same person who did Guy Ritchie's Man from U.N.C.L.E., so it had to be a classic soundtrack, Robin, you know?
Don't spoil this for me. Do not spoil this for me.
Oh.
By the end of the show, I would like you to tell me, Alex, exactly, what is Quantum of Solace about?
It's the sequel to Casino Royale. You need to see them as two bookended films.
But then again, isn't Skyfall the bookend to that particular sequence?
That's the trilogy, exactly. Let's move on. Richard, not comrades or comrade, dear comrade, talk us through this interesting movie, which Rebecca and I were both confused about. And in the end, we said, look, we'll just let Richard talk about this and then we'll decide whether we want to go and see it, probably from the Curzon Cinema. Likewise with Robin. Over to you, Richard.
Well, no. It is, of course, the Curzon Cinema one. You're referring, however, to the Indian movie, Dear Comrade. And yeah, I see that. Similar title. I do find political movies and docudramas fascinating. I mean, you're thinking of Andrzej Wajda's Katyn about the massacre of the Polish officer corps by the Soviets during the Second World War. You're thinking of Gillo Pontecorvo's The Battle of Algiers, which was absolutely superb, perhaps one of the best, I'd say, that I've seen about the Algerian Civil War, or perhaps Costa Gavras's Z about the Lampreakis affair. I mean, all these are absolutely riveting. And so this is a genre I like. And the director of this, Andrei Konchalovsky, has based the story on the 1962 massacre at Novocherkassk, where the workers demonstrated because of rising prices. And this was at the time after Khrushchev had revealed the evils of Stalin's regime. But nonetheless, we have a portrait of a sclerotic bureaucracy, and also an ideological, a regime that ideologically is way, way beyond the pale. I mean, one of the interesting aspects of this movie, because normally when you have films dealing with revolutions of one sort of another, or indeed protests of one type or another, you see the incident and there's a build-up, and you see it from the point of view of the workers or those who are oppressed and why they act as they do and for what reason and how it develops. We see also, usually, a completely different angle to it, because what's fascinating about this movie, which I really found very, very intriguing, and that is we see it from the point of view, firstly, of Ludmilla, who is played by Julia Vyelskaya, and played extremely well, I have to say. It's her particular journey that she goes on, and the emotional trauma that this involves is particularly interesting. She is a member of the local Communist Party committee, and what's intriguing, particularly in the first hour of this film, is you see almost the whole thing from the point of view of the apparatchiks, which it really is quite unique. I have not seen it previously. And what was particularly interesting, too, you see her with a character called Viktor, who's played by Vladislav Komarov. He's the head of the local committee. They've raised food prices. It's a policy of the regime to do it. And anything that Moscow dictates is, of course, biblical when it comes to local apparatchiks, who know very well that a slightest slip and they'll be, well, either they'll vanish, or they'll be exiled to some ghastly place where they'll have no future at all. And the fear, one of the aspects of this movie that's very effective, it's shot in black and white, it gives that a docudrama quality. It's the absolute fear of each person who's linked to the Communist Party and whatever might happen if they were to make any comment, which in any way could cause problems for those above. And above, they're terrified of the different layers where if you offended anyone, and the whole thing is completely bogus ideologically, this would be the end of you. And when the workers actually march, it causes dreadful confusion. This is the question of food prices that they can't afford. And it's quite interesting that we see Ludmilla, she has an affair with Victor. They sleep together more or less as a matter of convenience, we see in the first scene, and they do discuss the problems. But of course, they're together. The moment they're anywhere in public, nothing can be discussed because it doesn't exist. And if there's no problem, it's rather like the massacre, which in itself, once it's happened, doesn't exist officially. Nothing exists.
It's an effective way of governing. I mean, surely this is the sort of thing that really, you know, Orwell was so right in 1984, and it's why the Kremlin would actually use 1984 as a way to keep the population under control. Honestly, if you're going to actually raise food prices, you might have some workers who will rebel. It's a bit like raising cinema ticket prices. Oh, no. Let's turn to Robin.
May I just finish just a comment about this? It is... One of the reasons it's so effective, as I say, is the way it's filmed and the way it's somewhat surprisingly the way we see events. But there are rather curious aspects to this film. Firstly, it is accepted that there were ghastly casualties when the army opened fire on the workers. Well, in the film, it's the KGB who opened fire, having been secretly placed to do precisely that. The army fire above, although you don't actually see it, it's quite an interesting way that the massacre's cut. You could, I mean, certain massacres such as that in Dr. Zhivago, where you see it reflected in Omar Sharif's face, it's intriguing. And this is unusual from that point of view. The other point I would say, which weakens the film all as well, is the friendship that develops between Loginov, who's a KGB man stationed there and a senior one, and Ludmilla, because she wants to know what's happened to her daughter, who was among the protesters. What has indeed, it builds up a certain amount of dramatic tension, but it isn't as convincing as the scenes in the first hour plus. It's a 2-hour movie.
Хорошо, товарищ. And now on to Comrade Robin. Robin, what would you say in terms of what was originally, of course, entitled Дорогие товарищи? Will you be checking out Dear Comrades through the Curzon Home Cinema? And you might have to unmute yourself as well. The little red light there.
Right. I couldn't get this on any of the normal streaming services that I use. I'd have to subscribe.
It's an elitist. It's the Curzon Home Cinema elite routine. You have to register then, go through all sorts of things to get there.
But they actually, may I add, they will give it. They will allow you to see it free if you explain why you're watching it.
I think that from the point of Saturday afternoon entertainment, it's probably a niet, but it might be a da for some time midweek.
And Rebecca, from your own perspective, is this something which you think, yes, now I know it's all about those rations and the way forward, clearly I'll go for that?
It does sound interesting, and it sounds like it reflects historical issues, so I think that's something I'd definitely watch.
It does reflect historical issues. As I say, it's a very, the actual way the massacre is filmed is very effective. I still puzzle as to why this literally was, as you see in the film, completely the word whitewash applies even to the fact that new asphalt was put down the next day to make sure there were no bloodstains. The whole
now event... that's efficiency, Richard. You've got to say that's efficiency. That's totalitarian state efficiency.
I thought it would appeal to you, Alex. The shameful thing is that this was completely hushed up in the Soviet Union until 1982. I mean, it really, really is. It's a portrait of an evil society. I would make the point that the performances are extremely good, and particularly Julia Vyatskaya as Ludmilla, excellent. And yes, very, in fact, I have to say the bureaucrats are wonderfully portrayed. It's precisely what you'd get, but it's at its most realistic, showing from a totally unique, as I mentioned, point of view, what happened from the point of view of those who have to manage it, as opposed to those who were protesting, which is the normal way of handling the movies of this sort, and for obvious reasons. So it's an ingenious movie.
It's also nice to say that many of the bureaucrats who would actually follow those particular techniques and strategies, they're probably alive and well and living in higher education these days. I won't mention any names, but that's a different line entirely. So,
you're quite, actually, Alex, you're perfectly right in the your reference when it comes to actually, you know, for your crimes, do you pay for it? Are you ever put on trial? The answer, of course, and I no doubt you relate this to higher education today as well, is not one single person was. Nobody was ever blamed for what happened. It didn't exist.
Then again, you had Wernher von Braun, who, you know, developed the X1 and the X2, and he became practically top dog at NASA. Precisely. And put America on the moon.
Which just goes to show...
He never stood trial either.
There was something positive even about Donald Trump, as I'll say, in years to come. But there we are. Okay, that's pretty much wrapped up our particular sequence today. Robin, would you like to throw those last two questions at the dynamic duo that are Richard and Rebecca? Over to you. In fact, notice it's been the R show. It's been an R-rated movie review. Robin, Rebecca and Richard.
Right, if I may ask the lady whose name is Bond, Rebecca Bond, first. Have you had a reasonably interesting and enjoyable Zoomer with us this morning?
Very interesting and very enjoyable, thank you.
And will you return?
I will indeed be returning, yes.
Now the spotlight goes on Richard. Richard, have you had a reasonably interesting Zoomer with us this morning?
I have, most certainly, Robin. May I say I'm delighted you enjoyed Enola Holmes as much as you did, because it is a joy, absolutely.
And in the words of Christopher Lee's Fu Manchu, Richard, will the world hear from you again?
I hope it will, and I intend...
They're coming to arrest him now.
My work here is done.